Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to HR and Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and somewhere is normally Bushwick, but today it's Industry City. I'm Kat Johnson with Heritage Radio Network, and I'm here with my co-host and colleagues, Katie Mosman-Wadler. Hey, Kat. Happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday.
And Hannah Forden.
Happy Thursday, Industry City. It's beautiful. Saw a double rainbow today.
That's magical.
We came out of the subway, and there was a double rainbow. And then we saw another amazing thing on the way to Industry City.
Alana Glazer.
We saw Alana. Actually, Hannah saw Alana, and then she was like, that was Alana, and I was like, I wasn't looking!
And I didn't pass out on the floor.
I did. After. Just the thought of it. But I think Alana didn't notice us because she was looking at the double rainbow behind us. Otherwise, I'm sure she would have definitely come back to be on HR and Happy Hour.
For sure.
Next time. Alana, I know you're listening. Please join us.
Alana, there's hummus here.
We're super excited about our guests on today's show because there are guests, but we're also their guests. Please welcome Christine Sahadi Whalen and Pat Whalen. Thank you both for having us. We're in Sahadi's at Industry City.
Oh, thanks so much. We're so excited that you're here to broadcast, that we're broadcasting out of here. It's great. We're really delighted.
Awesome. So we're going to get more into our interview with Christine and Pat. But first, we have a couple of announcements. We always do announcements. And this week, we want to make sure everybody knows that we're going to be doing this every single week through fall. So join us at Industry City next week. We're going to be welcoming Nate Adler of Gertie in Williamsburg and Claire Sprouse of Hunky Dory in Crown Heights. We're going to be at Camp David just across the way. So join us. We're going to have bites and drinks once again, and come join us for more live podcasts. You can go to our Facebook page and see every single live podcast we're going to be doing throughout the fall. We're going to have Ed Levine of Serious Eats, Billy Durney from Hometown Barbecue. It's an amazing lineup, so don't miss out.
We're super, super stoked about that. Also, we have to put in a plug for our upcoming gala, November 11th. Everybody's invited, and you can use a discount code. It's HRNHappyHour. You can get 10% off your ticket. It's a taste around at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. Find all the information with Will up in the front here, or if you're listening to this on a podcast, go to heritageradionetwork.org/gala. Would love to see you there.
Awesome. Okay, so we turn back to Pat and Christine. So, Christine, you've been on HRN before. You've joined us at Roberta's. So folks can go and listen to those interviews and get a lot of backstory about Sahadi's. But and then, Pat, have you been on HRN before? Is this your first time?
First time.
Welcome.
Yes.
We're very glad to have you.
Yes.
We won't haze you too much today.
Thank you.
So we're obviously in this brand new space, but let's take it back a little bit. And Christine, can you tell us a bit about your family's history and the Sahadi story?
Sure. So my grandfather came over in 1919, and he was 18 years old. And he went to work for his uncle in Lower Manhattan, which is on the site of where the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel is now. And he worked for his uncle for about 20 years and then decided he wanted to go out on his own. So he opened his own shop, and then the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel came, along with the drilling and the noise, and it was very disruptive. Even though it didn't actually displace the community, it was very disruptive. So he moved to Atlantic Avenue, which is where our store still stands, in 1948. And he moved the shop there, and we are still there. We've expanded widthwise, so we were one store, and now we're three stores. We opened the second store in 85 and the third store in 2012, but it's all one big, it's all connected. And we're still there. We're just, you know, we used to be mostly Middle Eastern with a little bit of specialty. Originally, we were all Middle Eastern, but I want to say now we're probably a lot of specialty with a focus on Middle Eastern.
Mm-hmm. So I think one thing people love about Sahadi's is just sort of like the style of shopping and being able to go in and buy bulk and buy all these spices that you can't get other places. Was that sort of always the way that shopping happened at Sahadi's, or did it evolve over time?
That's always the way shopping happened at Sahadi's. Like, even when we first started, I mean, it used to be we used to open the top of the bag and roll down the top, and we used to sell it out of the bag. And then we evolved into, okay, we'll buy a display that actually holds the bag. And now we do a mix of, packaging ourselves in-house and selling bulk out of trays or bins or whatever display is currently approved by New York City. But it actually, we haven't changed all that much in the way we do business. You still are going to walk up, even from 70 years ago, a clerk or one of our customer service people is going to talk to you, ask you what you're looking for, and service you, to put things in a bag, answer questions, perhaps give you techniques of what you can do with it, or just generally tell you where it came from, or hopefully give you whatever information it is that you need.
I'm curious, so I grew up going to Sahadi's. I grew up in Carroll Gardens, and it was always like a major destination. And there's something very immersive and like multi-sensory, especially as a kid. You're looking around at all the jars and you're like, what's in there? I want to touch everything. I can't touch everything. And I'm curious, as the neighborhood has changed and so many more people are moving to Brooklyn Heights, Cobble Hill, Carroll Garden, the surrounding areas, and there's a very specific style of shopping that you have to use when you're at Sahadi's, right? It's much more interactive. It's not, entirely self-serve. People are used to the bulk bins at Whole Foods, et cetera. So I'm curious about the sort of like learning curve and shift in like how your amazing staff interacts with customers who might not be used to the Sahadi's style.
Just like you see all the time on social media, it's a Sahadi's, you have to take a number. It should be the first thing you do when you get in. Atlantic Avenue, the first thing you do when you walk in the store should be take a number. That way you can browse while you're waiting for your number to come up, especially if it's on a Saturday or during the holiday season. If you don't take a number, you tend to be fairly irritated that you didn't realize that you should have taken a number and you're kind of stuck. So my staff is really pretty good about parroting almost every 5 minutes. Please take a number as soon as you come in. Please take a number, because we want the customer to be able to wander and, just take it all in. And we don't want you to feel trapped waiting for your number to come up. But if you don't realize that, I mean, it's not like we can't stand somebody at the door and say, please take a number. So one of the guys will call out every 5 minutes, grab a number. And that way you know that you can then wander. And sometimes the other customers will take pity on you if they can see you don't know what to do. And they'll help you out as you arrive, which is really kind of nice. We're very much a community store. And a lot of our customers, well, probably 80% of them are return customers. Sure. So it's kind of, they all know each other, and during the holidays they're all talking, and, oh, I haven't seen you in so long. So I think that the whole experience, watching other people, it becomes more natural. And every once in a while when it's not, we apologize and scoot them in the middle of the line.
Yeah, it's a group activity.
Exactly, exactly.
How did you first become involved with the family business, and what is your role now, and how has that sort of been part of your career plans or not?
I've always wanted to do this. So when I was younger, I mean, I had other jobs, local jobs. We live, a few miles from the store, and it wasn't always convenient. But I always wanted to do this. I've been working on and off weekends since I'm probably eight. We used to pack a lot of stuff by hand. So when the younger generation always, that's what our job always was, to package things. So, but I've always enjoyed it. And all through college, I went to NYU, and at the time there were no food degrees, so my specialty is international business and finance, which was great. I took the first food course NYU ever had because I was so excited there was one in college that I could get credit for.
What was it?
I don't remember. It was a course on the history of food. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was in the sociology department.
Uh-huh.
But it was really interesting, and I thought, wow. And now you can have whole degrees in this, and at the time you couldn't, which is fabulous. But at the time you couldn't. But I always wanted to do this. I always wanted to do something in food. I always enjoyed cooking. I did 2 years of culinary studies in between my degree at NYU because I loved food, but it didn't seem like it was going to, it wasn't a college path at the time. Mm-hmm. But I came right in after college to do this. And when I came in, we opened the prepared foods department when I came in full time, because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to cook. I wanted to be not just on the retail end of it, but also on the back end of it. And I'm so glad I did. I worked I ran the prepared foods for about, my mom and I did together, for about 5 years, and then we hired a chef, and I worked my way through the whole, every area of the store. I mean, I do everything, I've done everything from buying to floor retail to the actual cooking, catering, whatever it needs to be. I mean, in small business, you do everything. And I'm happy to do everything. It actually gives me a better sense of what I do and why I do it.
Pat, I'm curious about your path now to Sahadi's.
Wasn't quite that simple. A couple of years on Wall Street, and then Christine's dad approached me about coming into the business, and I initially refused.
Why?
I didn't want to work for my father-in-law.
Yeah.
It's no deeper than that.
Uh-huh.
And then relented after a weekend and bought in as a partner, Christine and I, into another business that they were looking to acquire. And that's where I started, in the nut roasting side of the business. And that was 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a long road since then.
Did you have an interest in food before, like when you were working at Wall
Street? No, not really. I mean, it was curious about running our own business at the time. And I was egotistical enough to think I could do it, even though I knew nothing about it. And it kind of worked out.
Yeah. So we're obviously here in this brand new space. When did Sahadi's at Industry City open?
So we opened the 29th of August.
Okay.
And it's been a whirlwind.
I imagine.
It's very different than building horizontally to open something totally different. Wow. It's been a real experience. I mean, thank God that there's been a lot of support here. And Pat and I and my brother Ron, who's not here today, have worked hand in hand trying to figure out all the different components that are just different than what we're used to doing.
Talk more about that. Like, obviously, you're able to open one whole space like at a time, whereas before you kind of expanded from the one store. So you're able to start from scratch. What are your big dreams? What do you want to do? What works? What doesn't work?
This store has everything that we wanted to do at Atlantic Avenue. I mean, they're not all open yet. Not every department is open yet. But I think that, like, we would all look at Atlantic and maybe talk about, well, if we could do whatever we wanted to do, what would we do? We'd put in a pita bread oven. We'd bring an assage. We'd do our own packaging lines, as opposed to Atlantic Avenue. We do a lot of stuff on different floors. We had the luxury of building to suit here, essentially. And Industry City has been super supportive about all the things that we wanted to do here, and really just interested in everything and always willing to support us with things, which was great. Pat's really very involved in construction and stuff, which is definitely not my end of it. I do not like it, and I do not have much patience for the nitty-gritty engineering that has to go in behind the scenes. Pat happens to be
like
really
zero.
Great at that. Yeah, I really don't like it. But he's really good at it. So it's actually worked out. And my brother, Ron, is very good on the electronics end. So he does a lot of website things, cash registers, all that. Another thing that I absolutely do not like.
But it's so important.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. You need all those components. But if I had to do all of those components, I don't know if I would have taken on a project of this size. It benefits any one of us to have partners that are, you know, I do the creative end of it with the food. And, you know, Pat does the structural end of it, and Ron does the electronics end of it, and it makes it a very smooth, well, as smooth as it could be.
Actually, I think it was probably even more difficult to take a raw space, because in a small space, or what Christine had to do before, you only had a little piece. This was Pandora's box. Mm-hmm. It opened up like blank slate, clean slate. What would you do? And it was, what, about a year? 2 years? As the process changed
from the beginning,
transformed,
to the end,
yeah. And you know, we were taking Atlantic Avenue and making Stu Leonard's, a little path through the store.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you turn around and look at the space, it's nowhere near that. So, like Christine said, all of a sudden, what can you do?
Right. Can you kind of, for listeners who are not in the room with us, can you kind of walk us through all the different departments? I see there's like a little herb garden, you have a little wine bar. Can you talk about all of the different components and especially things that are different from what you have on Atlantic Ave?
Sure. We wanted this store to be more immersive for people. We wanted people, at Atlantic Avenue, it's very much take a number, get what you need, move. It's crowded. It's busy. It's crowded. And because of the dynamics, the architectural challenges of three buildings being put to one store, the flow is more, I'm just going to grab what I need, wander through. It's more treasure hunting. I'm just going to sit there. I'm going to figure out what I want. I'm going to go. We wanted this store to be a place where people could linger, because the number one thing that we hear at Atlantic over and over is, you have no place to sit. We have no place where we can relax and enjoy all these wonderful things. So we built a lot of this store. We built a cafe out knowing that we wanted to have a seating area, that we wanted to bring in Mediterranean wines and beers. So we built based on that. We figured that should be in the courtyard area, in the area where people would be most likely to sit. And then we built the store around it. So if you come in from the entrance, which we consider most likely to be the street entrance, the first thing you're going to see is the nuts and the fruits and the candies, because that's the first thing you see when you walk into Atlantic. And we didn't want it to be an unfamiliar experience to people. We wanted people to walk in and go, this smells like Atlantic Avenue. It looks like Atlantic, but it doesn't look like Atlantic. That's what we were trying to do. So you walk into the nuts and the fruits, you then hit the cheeses, which is very similar to the path you also take at Atlantic. And you wind up at the end, at the before the register, at the deli. Or here, of course, we have the sausage and the pita working in tandem with the deli, which is, we wanted people to hang out and look. Mm. So like people come in and they're like, you don't have pita bread in like trays. I'm like, no, but we're baking it. If you just give us 5 minutes, the bags will be full. You know, so it's just it's a different experience, but a similar experience. Mm-hmm. But people linger. I mean, I see it on the weekends. They get up, they have something to eat, they go back and they do some grocery shopping. That's what we really wanted to do. We wanted a sense of community that was less rushed. So it's a little, we have less SKUs, but we have very carefully curated SKUs of things that Atlantic Avenue customers love. We kind of talked to people, listened to people, and looked at what we can import ourselves. And because a lot of our products we do bring ourselves. And then we did it. And I think that I'm happy, very happy with the product mix. I'm really happy with the interaction with the customers that I have less. It was harder for me to do at Atlantic, because here I'm in the middle of everything, which is great. But I'm also loving seeing all my Atlantic customers on the weekends. Mm-hmm. It's so sweet. In the weekends, I'm always, at least 10 people come up to me and go, you know, I'm an Atlantic Avenue customer, but I came just to see the shop. And that makes me feel great. It really makes all of us feel great that we struck a balance between new and old, mm-hmm. you know, between our historical and more modern.
So in saying you have fewer SKUs in this store, and you have to sort of predict what being in a different neighborhood is going to like represent as far as demand. It's very early days. We're 6 weeks in.
Right.
But have you felt like you were kind of able to predict, you know, kind of what selection you should have here? Has there been any like demand that surprised you? How are you going to sort of evolve that as people get settled in here?
It's been very different. It's the SKUs that sold here are the SKUs I expected to sell here based on the demographics. I spent months here listening to people, having lunch in other places, walking around so that we could make a choice about which curated items were going to work and which ones weren't going to work. It's so interesting that a few things I thought were not going to work at all work wonderfully here. And yet things that fly at Atlantic do not sell as well here and vice versa. And my brother and I still talk about it on a fairly regular basis. Like, I'll say, I don't know why this doesn't sell with you. And yet it's selling here. And I guess the demographic here is I definitely think it's younger mm-hmm. than the demographic at Atlantic. Atlantic has a lot of traditional customers that have been shopping for a really long time. Here, a lot of customers don't know us. So they're coming in, they're in the store for the first time. It's interesting to talk to the customers and, you know, just hear what they say. But I think overall, we are happy with the product mix we curated. We're going to, of course, we'll tweak it as we go along, and also by what we import. So Pat does all the importing, and imported items that we import just for ourselves are like our babies. Those are items that we truly care about. So I think that, I mean, some of the people that he's developed partnerships with are people that he talks to all the time. There's a story there, and it's nice that we can share that. And that's something that we probably will bring back to Atlantic as we see which items are going well. Those are going to be items that are definitely going to make their way onto the shelves. We're just still trying to figure it out.
Can you tell us about some of those? Like, what are some of those products that are just, like, so close to your heart and some of those stories that you're excited to share?
Well, one of the product lines we have is an NGO line out of Lebanon, which is a nonprofit group that helps refugees and goes into these towns and teaches them how to make a product and then tries to find a partner somewhere to sell it. And they came to us, what, about 2 years ago, Chris? Something like that. And we immediately picked it up and said, we'll be your first guys in the United States. We'll partner with you. They do organic fair trade wine. They do villages all over Lebanon with Syrian refugees that they're teaching how to make little products. And we immediately, sight unseen, ordered, I don't know, 40 SKUs.
Wow.
And they're super excited to be working with us. So this is the first time they've been in the States. We've been open 5 weeks. So 5 weeks.
And so that seems like, you know, this space might be a little more conducive to communicating
Absolutely.
That background to a customer. How do you go about doing that?
It's our job.
Nice. Very nice. Well, the advantage to being here is there are less SKUs on the shelf. So if there's less SKUs on the shelf, the SKUs can speak for themselves more. Also, product testing, we open up jars. I mean, if a customer shows even the slightest interest in something, that means another customer wants to try it. We'll open it up. We're happy to put a sample out. I mean, when we choose a product like that and really commit to it, I mean, we're bringing a lot of volume. If we're going to commit to bringing a container of something, we truly know we really believe in that product. We believe in the people behind it and the quality of the product, of course. We go out of our way to communicate that. So, I mean, those are the items that you're going to see when you see a cheese platter. That's the gem that's going to be on there. When when we do a house wine, that's the wine we're going to serve. We try to do it holistically so that from every angle you're trying these products and you're getting an opportunity to. And a lot of the SKUs on the shelf in this store are not SKUs that you're going to see somewhere else. We deliberately eliminated anything that was likely to show up at a Target or at a supermarket because you don't need me then. Mm-hmm. So we only curated products that we felt were more in keeping with the family thing. So a lot of the products are small batch. And that line was a perfect example of that. But that carries through to a lot of the SKUs in the store. The SKUs that we took from Atlantic were almost exclusively SKUs that we know the people that make the product, which I feel like that's kind of where I want to be in retail today. I want to be on the small end. I want to be the retailer that gives somebody a chance. So when somebody comes in and they buy chocolate from me and they make this really great tahini butter cup and they say, can I get this on your shelf? And I say yes, and I buy it. They can't go to a lot of stores today and do that. So I think that's part of what this shop was about for me, was about going backwards a little bit to smaller manufacturers and just all these great makers who make a product that they're passionate about, mm-hmm. as opposed to just picking things that are really marketable because they get a lot of publicity.
Christine said something about family before. And part of the process of us doing this is a family business and a family culture. And what felt really good to us when we came to Industry City, it was 5 or 6 years ago when we started looking here. They're building a family culture here. They were very supportive when we started building this space out. And we literally, 2 years ago, sat at a table, a lot of the guys here, threw our ideas on the table together to develop this space. And one of the themes to it was the Mediterranean culture is a family culture. You sit, you share, you break bread. That's why obviously this is a podcast. People aren't seeing what I'm seeing. But next to the farm shells and growing and the greenery is a giant community table dead center in the middle of the store. And what that represents is a family sharing and breaking bread. It was really a collaborative process when we did this. And that culture that Christine was talking about is that we kept going back to it. Family culture. Sitting down with grandparents and little kids. So all of these tables are designed to be put together. The outdoors are designed to be shared. And as you walk around this campus, you get that same feeling. These are small business people. These are family businesses all working together here. And it's been an absolutely phenomenal experience for us.
I'm sort of curious, as a family business, sort of about your attitude towards risk versus kind of responsible sourcing and really caring about, not just what is the story behind the product, but what is the impact of this product kind of on the greater world, and then being able to offer that at a price that people in the neighborhood can also afford. I mean, margins in food are really small, and then to say, you want to work with a local producer who's got, doesn't have a huge amount of capacity, you're kind of taking on a lot of risk in that business. How do you sort of go about balancing that?
It like you said, margins of food are small, and we know that going in, but look, there's so much. I mean, you could get food dropped in your backyard today. You could get, like, what is going to make us, what is going to make you come here? So the truth is that I hope what makes you come here is that we care about our staff, we care about where we buy things, we care about the people we're buying them from, we develop relationships. All of that, whether it to the customer separates me from Key Food or separates me from a larger corporation, to me it does. It matters to me. It matters. I mean, when we choose products, when we choose who we do business with, a lot of what we are looking to do is relationship based. So yeah, it matters to me. It matters to me if they use sustainable packaging. It matters to me if I can, if I'm not going to bring something from the Middle East, then I'm going to get the slowest carbon footprint I can. I'm going to try to buy somebody who, I'm going to try to get it from somebody who made it four blocks away, because there's no reason to drag it from California. If it's a small batch product, somebody in Brooklyn is definitely making it. And if not Brooklyn, Staten Island, New Jersey, you know what I mean? The Queens, there are people everywhere all around us that are passionate about products. So we try to balance it out. I mean, the most of the way we do everything, we still run ourselves very much. I mean, true, the more you grow, the more you have to be more business-like, but we still function very much as a family. I mean, almost everything is run by either me, Pat, or my brother, Ron. I mean, we're very hands-on. When we opened this store, two or three of the newest staff who had just come on said, I have never seen an owner working side by side. I am not comfortable if I'm not part of what I'm doing. So I want my partners to be the same way. I want my partners to be people that pay their employees, that care, like, we always look for fair trade. I mean, some of the countries that you buy products from do not always have the most equitable way of distributing money. And we try as best we can to choose people like these, like, you know, that are nonprofits or something to do business with, because they've been very amenable to making even flavors that we wanted that were not on their original list. And I'm grateful, because sometimes you can't find people who can do that. But today there's a lot of interest, and people are willing to pay a few cents more if they know that something's, I mean, look, I'm not trying to make $86 on a jar of jam, but if you, I think that people are especially in this area in New York City, and certainly in most of the areas that I've done business in, are willing to pay a few cents more for a product that they know was sustainably raised, or any of those things that are important to them. And those are important not just to me, but to other people.
I have a question that I would love for both of you to answer, which is, like, if you woke up tomorrow and the universe had gotten all screwed up and you worked in your same job but for a big box grocery store, what would be the first three things that you would do in your job?
First three things what?
That you would do if you woke up, you had your same job, but you worked for a big box grocery store.
Quit, and quit.
Okay. Okay, there you go.
All right, I guess I should have put in a stipulation that you're stuck there for one day.
Oh. Your resignation is not accepted. Yeah. What do you do?
Wait a day, then quit.
Is there anything you can do?
It's difficult. When you... One of the luxuries we have as a family business is not having to answer to a dollar. Mm-hmm. You know, Christine, I, and Ronnie can override that maximizing thing. And actually, I don't think any of us really think about it. You know, it's usually the value and the relationship over everything else. And what you described to me is something that's going to be truly dollars and cents driven. And I don't think at this stage in my career I could live with that. I don't think I'd be able to survive today.
So you think a publicly traded grocery store is
absolutely
not fixable?
Not.
I don't know, not fixable. It's just, there are just not things that, there's a reason why we never looked to become part of a greater, you know, thing where people always come, oh, we can buy you. There's something to be said for, like I said, for being able to get a small, somebody, you can't walk into Costco with a teeny buttercup and say, I'd like to sell this on your shelf, and somebody's going to go, oh yeah, I'll buy some. They don't work like that. But I would definitely, things that I dislike that I would avoid, big box retail is a huge on packaging. Yeah. I'm absolutely not. Like, I'm the first one to go, do you have to put it in that big plastic carton? Like, and I think that you can't, on a broader level, certainly at the retail level, you have no control over that in a big box. You have to be at the way up at the corporate level before you can start making noises about packaging. So I think, like, and the other thing is, we're really funny about our staff. Like, I know every member of my staff. I know their birthday. I know their kids. Part of what we do is that back end. Like, we all work together, and I have people that have been working for me on Atlantic for 30, 35 years. I mean, my manager there has been with me since I'm 20, and I am way older than 20 now. So I think that, I don't know that I would be able to work in an environment where family first wasn't something that we're used to having. I mean, when people come and, you know, things are wrong or things are right, that's what we do. We function as a group and we make it work. And I don't know that I wasn't ever in an environment that was so sterile.
Answer is quit too?
That it would work.
Yeah, sounds like it.
I would be very stressed out, needless to say. But I just think that there's something more intimate. No matter how big we are, we're still here. There's something more intimate that I just don't know. Then again, I don't shop at big box retailers, so. I don't even like the shopping experience for the reason
you're
that
both just like, get me out of here.
We kind of like, I'm the kind who still likes to walk along to see the butcher. Like,
yeah,
that's the way I was brought up. That's the way I'm comfortable. And when I travel, that's what Pat and I love to do. We look in the local markets. I think that we are, what we like to do across the board, whether we're at work or out of work, is always about relationships and about talking to people and about this sense of community. Like he said, that's the reason that after 70 years we decided to open another store, and this is the first location, because
that's exactly
we felt
why
really
we
confident
this place.
Here
exactly
with the
why.
Team, and we felt really like there were real people and everybody was really interested in what we were doing. I mean, we've been asked dozens of times, we've seen 100 locations, and I was like, this is fine, but we're not feeling that this is a good fit. And then we came here and we were like, I think this is a good fit. So, here we are.
Well, on that note, we're going to get to trivia in just a second, but speaking of Industry City, we do want to give a quick word to our sponsors and our amazing host, Industry City, for having us here. Industry City is New York's hub for the innovation economy. A diverse mix of over 500 businesses call IC home, collaborating across the 16-building campus, merging today's creative sectors like tech, content creation and design with craft making and traditional manufacturing. The Industry City food scene is a rich yet approachable international experience for every palate. With 5 acres of outdoor space, more than 50 experimental food vendors and retailers, plus unrivaled tenant amenities, Industry City is a bustling hub where 8,000 people come to work daily and thousands stop by for a visit. Thanks to Industry City for having us. So on that note, Pat and Christine, do you have any other, I mean, it's hard to pick any other favorite neighbors, but what are you excited about with Industry City right now? Who in this campus are you thrilled to be here? Where do you eat? Where do you shop?
Here.
Well, obviously. Every day, right?
No. Every other day. Honestly, right over your shoulder, I'm looking across right at Moore Brothers. It was one of the first guys we started talking to before we started doing this. We talked about, well, what about if we did like a wine and cheese tasting? What about if we gave you cheese like 2 weeks before and then we set something up on every Thursday? There's a lot of that going on here. It's really difficult just to pick one guy. I would say we know most everybody by now, right, Christine?
I love it here. I know
really?
Everybody. I'm like, I go to yoga every day. Everybody's waving to me. It's like, I love it here. Like, it's just very, there's probably not a place, at least not a place certainly in this area that I have not patronized. During the 4 months that we were starting to open, we would come down. I would tell my two managers who were with me, go somewhere different every day for lunch. Every day I want you to go somewhere different. And I want you to come back and tell me what you ate that was fabulous. And I had a whole list in my inbox of all the great meals they ate. And there isn't a place that I've gone here that I haven't just thought it was great. You know, even during social things, you'll see people from every business. I think it's just a lot of fun.
3 or 4 years ago, when we were thinking about this, I had a couple of vendors fly in with me, and they were like, what are you talking about? I said, come on, get in the car. And by the time we hit the first courtyard to the second courtyard, you see them looking around, looking this way, looking up. And then they turn around and look at me and said, you feeling me now? Said, this is amazing. I said, yeah, come back in 2 years.
Yeah.
And when they've come back, their jaws drop. It's just a really, really awesome ecosystem.
It's amazing history here. It's beautiful, the way that the courtyards are laid out. If you're listening out there and you're not here tonight, you need to get down to Industry City and just spend the day walking around and eating everything you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. There's so much good food here. It's insane.
Yeah. Okay, so it's that time. I warned Christine. I don't know if word got to you, Pat, but we play a little bit of trivia.
Sorry. We're sorry, not sorry.
You're being warned now.
It's a podcast, right?
It's a podcast.
and we were going to ask for help from our live audience here. So usually in studio, we have sound effects when someone gets an answer correct or gets an answer incorrect. So if Pat or Christine get a correct answer, I'm going to give you a thumbs up, and you'll go ding, 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 ding. You guys on practice?
All right.
Awesome. Yeah.
Oh, that and went so much better than I thought. I'm really
that was beautiful.
You guys yeah, no anything. Confidence,
natural
Katie.
Sound effect makers.
Sorry okay, for doubting.
I doubt that they'll get any wrong, but if they do, I'll give you a thumbs down. You go, okay, perfect.
Wow. Okay. And also, then after, if they get it wrong, we'll give everyone a chance to chime in. Okay. Because Sahadi's is such a Brooklyn business with such strong Brooklyn roots, we have some trivia I'm calling been in Brooklyn since 1948. That's the right year, right? Excellent. I got one right.
There you go.
All right. Question number one. What shipping, warehousing, and manufacturing complex was built in the early 20th century and was originally named Bush Terminal after its owner, Irving T. Bush?
Industry City.
Hey!
Excellent work.
That was a gimme, Kat.
That was a softball question.
Pandering.
I don't know. Question number two. Which world-famous GI shipped off to Germany from the Brooklyn Army Terminal in September 1958?
Elvis Presley.
Wow.
Nailed it. Question number three. In 1960, Topps Co. decided to make room in its Brooklyn warehouse by dumping boxes of baseball cards that sold poorly into the Atlantic Ocean. A certain 1952 edition now sells at $500,000 thanks to scarcity the dump created. Can you name the baseball player that was on that 1952 card?
Not a clue.
Yes, 1952. Come on, baseball.
No.
DiMaggio.
Not DiMaggio. Yeah, where's our buzzer? Come on.
The answer is Mickey Mantle.
Nice try.
All right, question number four. Which of these things was not invented in Brooklyn? The deep-fried Twinkie, Sweet and Low, teddy bears, or roller coasters?
Deep-fried Twinkie.
Ah! Oh.
You have another guess?
You go.
Teddy bears?
Nope.
Then it's the roller coaster because Sweet and Low
is Brooklyn. It's the roller coaster.
I only knew the one that was in Brooklyn.
Yep. The first real famous roller coaster was the Cyclone, but they were technically invented in Russia.
I guess I didn't know that.
Trick question. Yeah.
I feel like we still got that one as Brooklyn.
We should deserve credit.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, last question. The song You Don't Bring Me Flowers was performed as a duet by which two singers who went to high school together in Flatbush?
Do you get partial credit if you get one?
Yeah.
Who singers from Flatbush?
One went to Broadway.
Nice.
Barbara Streisand and Neil Diamond.
Jane's got it.
You get a ding.
Good guess. Ding, ding, ding.
All right. You won trivia.
Woo!
Congratulations. Yeah.
Did we get hummus?
All the hummus.
You get a hummus.
All right. Well, I think that's our show, unless anyone has final words.
Well, thanks so much for having us. This was a lot of fun, and we're so happy that you broadcast out of here.
What are your hours here in Industry City?
Well, right now we're 10 to 5. Next week we are extending. We're still negotiating as to how much, but we should be, by next month, we should be open 10 to 7 at least, most of the week.
Nice. Love it. All right, I quickly want to thank our friends at Industry City, Katie, Lauren, Grant, Rob, and the rest of the team. I want to thank the City Farm team, Nick and Varghese, and Sahadi's, Pat and Christine, and the rest of their team for having us.
Thank you.
This has been HR and Happy Hour with Hannah, Katie, and me, Kat. We will see you here next week with Nate Adler from Gertie and Claire Sprouse from Hunky Dory. Please join us.
I can't believe it.
everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.